live special broadcast with The Intercept from 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to midnight, right here at democracynow.org and on many stations around the country. We have a number of positions that we are hiring for in our newsroom, outreach and development teams, information application deadlines at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Trina Nadura, Tamer Yass Studio, Adriana Contreras. I'm Amy Gunn-Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. It's time for Sojourner Truth Radio with Margaret Prescott, bringing you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. Then at 9, it's One Land, Many Voices, exploring political, social, and cultural issues affecting Palestine and Israel with host Leila Kinnan. At 10 o'clock, it's Voices for the Animals. We hear from Ingrid Newkirk, the legendary founder and president of People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, about her new book, Animal Kind. Then at 10:30, it's Film at 11, a panel broadcast reviewing the latest films and shows from the multiplex to the art house and beyond. Then at 11, it's Radio Zine with Suzanne Legrand, speaking with self-described radical plagiarist Sophia Trager and Catherine Rowland, the author of Pleasure Gap, American Women and the Unfinished Sexual Revolution. All these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Act Now on Climate Emergency, Thursday, February 27th, 4 to 7 p.m. at Portland City Hall. This climate emergency rally will demand annual steps to reduce carbon emissions by at least 8% each year and to end Zenith tar sand oil exports. Enjoy street theater, music, and a puppet show. Again, act on climate emergency this Thursday, 4 to 7 p.m., City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. More information can be found at kboo.fm's homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, the great poet, Nikki Giovanni. She is a national treasure. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Nikki Giovanni is a poet, activist, professor, mother. She's been given the keys to more than 24 cities, including New York City, Los Angeles, Miami. She's the author of at least 27 books. Her first book of poetry was published in 1968, entitled Black Feeling, Black Talk. Nikki Giovanni is a university distinguished professor in English at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. Nikki Giovanni, welcome.
Thank you.
So good to have you. There's so much more I could say about you, but we are so excited that you are here in studio and we can talk about your book, Chasing Utopia, and many other things. We were talking earlier today, and I was saying how I got distracted. I was supposed to be doing something else. You know, I was kind of on a schedule, and I started going through it. You could see all the little clips that I have here for some of the favorites. And then I looked at the clock, and it's like, how the time has flown.
Thank you. That's an honor, and thank you very much.
Right. Well, we have a bit of time. I wanted our audience to know a bit about you. You grew up in the segregated South?
Yes.
Was it? You were a child then. Did you realize that you were living under segregation as a child? Did you know anything about the impact on your family, your mom, your dad?
Everybody black knew, you know, that there was segregation. Uh-huh. I am a Knoxvillian. I'm a Tennessean by birth. I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee. And the family, my father and mother moved to Cincinnati, but Cincinnati, the big sign at the train station was Gateway to the South, which always fascinated me because it seemed to me that it should be the opposite. It should always have been Gateway to the North. But Cincinnati was a segregated Dow drugstores wouldn't serve you. And I mean, there were a lot of things going on. Cities were redlined. And of course, you're aware of that. And the awareness of it is like the awareness of any other evil in the world. You know it. You know you don't want to be a part of it, but it's not going to warp you. I mean, I ended up one of the first poems, and I was just very fortunate, I guess, with that I wrote just describing it, my childhood as I saw it, was called Nikki Rosa, which is what they used to call me. And what I was saying in that poem is that all the while I was quite happy, you know, despite the fact that, for example, under Lyndon Johnson, you know, we're going to get and especially Richard Nixon, we're going to get this whole idea of poverty. Well, you didn't realize you lived in a poverty area until you saw the poverty map. And then you went like, oh, my goodness, we were poor.
Yeah.
Because everybody else was poor. And so looking at poverty is going to be very different when you're inside looking out. I don't know. I'm not a sociologist. And I don't really know what the impact of youngsters nowadays, both black American as well as our immigrant youngsters, how the impact of having the eyes of the world on you and you therefore having the eyes of the world on you, how that's going to affect the personality. But if you look at the 60s generation, you look at us, you look at, I'm 70 now, but you look at those of us born in 1943, somewhere along there. We are coming out of the war, and we're going to go through, of course, Brown versus Topeka, and we're going to go through the reaction of the country to that, which is going to be Emmett Till, and then you're going to go back into Daisy Bates in 1957, and we're going to get to 60 when we are 20, more or less, in 1920. Then you're going to get the Greensboro. We get four young men in Greensboro, and we're going to start the sit-in generation. Fortunately for all of us, we never believed what other people had to say about us. And I'm not so sure the youngsters today haven't incorporated the dislike that the nation has for us. There must be a better way to express that, but I think that a lot of times, a lot of the black and brown youngsters believe that what has been said is true.
Yeah.
So that's not good. I'm just 3 weeks, by the way, coming from Accra, Ghana, because my former student, Kwame Alexander, does a literacy program. And he called me like last year, because it takes about a year to get ready for it. And he said, Nikki, I need a keynote speaker for my conference. And I laughed. I said, oh, Kwame, I'm so glad you called me, because I know everybody. I said, what did you have in mind? And he said, Nikki, I knew what he had in mind. It's like, okay. So I went and got my shots. For me, of course, it was the yellow fever is a booster shot. And my passport stays up to par. And I want to say to everybody listening in, to everybody that you know, get a passport. If somebody says, what do you want for Christmas? Say a passport. If somebody says, what do you want for your birthday? Say a passport. Because you can't be a citizen of the United States today, let alone, you have to have a passport. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you have to have, you have to have your voting card. Mm-hmm. Just go, I don't care, who doesn't want, no. You have to vote. You have to go, and if you don't do anything, write your mother's name in. You have to go and register that you were here and that you care. And, of course, we know that there are friends of good people everywhere who are undocumented, and there are things that they're going to have difficulty taken care of. But for those of us who are native born or who can show that where we are, that have mm-hmm. a right, you got to have a passport and you got to have your voting card.
Yeah, and I mean, we've just seen in the last presidential election, I mean, this huge, and after that, with the Supreme Court decision taking away such a key part of the Voting Rights Act, I mean, the attack really on the right to vote.
Sure.
So you're absolutely yeah. right on time with
well,
that.
You know, I think the dumbest thing on God's earth, actually, is that prisoners are not allowed to vote because maybe you committed a horrible crime. These are not things I know, but we didn't execute you. And mm-hmm. since we didn't, you are still subject to the Constitution of the United States and its 10 amendments. Therefore, you should participate. How do we expect people to go to jail, to prison for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, 10 years, or some cases more, and then come out and be good citizens when we've denied them citizenship rights? Because they're still citizens. And you say, well, you know, they have to be punished. Well, you've punished them. But punishing them, you know, you're not allowed to not feed them. You're not allowed to beat them, no matter what Clarence Thomas might think. The Fourth Amendment does apply to prisoners. Mm-hmm. And we need to keep them involved in the community. What better way than that they vote?
There was the experience of the California prisoners who went on a hunger strike. They went for 59 days. I mean, it started out, Nikki Giovanni, with 30,000 participants. Of course, by day 59, that number had dropped. But the weight, you know, some of those men had lost, you know, 30, 40 pounds, and it was really going to begin to impact internal organs. But one of the things that they were saying, which underscores your point, mm-hmm. is that, okay, we have been inside, we're being punished, and we shouldn't be tortured. Some of those men were held in solitary confinement for decades.
Right.
22 hours in, you know, in a cell. And also the assumption is that you're the same person when you go in.
Yeah.
And somebody said, well, you know what, if you're in prison and after a year, you're not political, you're crazy. you know, you done lost your mind.
Yeah.
So your point is indeed
sure.
Very, very well put. And one of the things, indeed, I did want to talk with you a bit about as well, you clearly were involved in the civil rights movement, the Black movement. I mean, you, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, I'll need for you to, I know you told me that story earlier, to tell that story yet again. And I was in Washington, D.C., for the inauguration in 2000 and early 2009, I guess mm-hmm. it was. And a number of the former SNCCers, as they call themselves, you know, were there.
Yeah.
And I don't know for people, even people who didn't necessarily think, because a lot of people expected, oh, now we got the revolution, we got a Black president. Well, he's president of the United States, right? Not a civil rights leader. But I just wanted you to say a little bit about the significance of that for you. And there's been a lot of criticism, you know, some rightly so, of his policies.
So. Yeah. I know that I, among others, but I was asked, you know, was the election of Barack Obama in 2008, mm-hmm. you know, Martin Luther King's dream? And my answer was no.
No.
No, it wasn't. Martin Luther King was a leader and Barack Obama's a politician.
Yeah.
And I regret that he counts so poorly. And mm-hmm. he continues to count so poorly. I'm not a politician. I don't run for office. I'm just a poet. But he had to know that there were going to be people that were going to oppose him no matter what. So what you have to do, what any good politician does, and what the right wing has done and what the Tea Party has done, is they've shored up their base. But Mr. Obama has not shored up his base. And I am personally, and it means nothing, but I'm just personal. I was a friend of Rap Brown. I'm personally disappointed that he has not extended presidential pardon to Rap Brown.
That's
or
right.
Russ Means. Why
mm-hmm.
not? Because he's not going to be any more loved by Ted Cruz than if he didn't.
Yeah.
So what does he care?
Leonard Peltier.
I was going to say Leonard, yeah.
Yeah.
What does Obama care whether these people like him or not?
Mm-hmm.
Because the people that voted for you, the people that worked for him, the people that thought, you know, as we move into a more inclusive world, this is your base.
Yeah.
I remember George Bush used to say that, you know, and I'm no fan of Mr. Bush's. And he said, you know, some people, had that dinner, and he said to the people there, some people call you fat cats, but I call you my base. And you remember
that? I remember that.
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah,
and,
but he knew it. I mean, he knew it, and he worked it.
It was his base, and that's who he took care of.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Obama needed to take care
of his base.
And that's been a colossal failure. So
mm-hmm.
I'm very, very sorry. I think that has his presidency has not been what it should have been. And in my opinion, he's in like the bottom third of the presidents because the country has suffered. And it suffered for lack of definition. Barack should have known that everybody's not going to love him. So then you have to love the people who love you. That's your responsibility.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so tell us then, just stepping back a little bit then, about your early involvement in what would be called the movement.
Well, I mean, again, we're all, I think for my generation, finish your sentence, Nikki. For my generation, the one most outstanding event was the murder of Emmett Till, because Emmett was just a little bit older than we were. Emmett was just a little bit, actually the same age as my sister. If he had lived, they would all, you know, be the same age. And the murder of Emmett Till was so horrible that I think everybody, and I don't mean each and every, but those of us who are going to watch something like that, we're saying, oh, if this is what is in line for us, then we have to stop it now. Mm-hmm. It has to stop here. And so when you look at, well, of course, Emmett, the murder of Emmett Till was the response to Brown versus Board of Education. And Mississippi took it, you know, very, very seriously. And they killed that 14-year-old. Yeah. And so we had that. We watched that. And then, of course, 1957, which is only going to be 2 years later, we've got Daisy Bates and the Little Rock Nine, and watching them spin on Miss Minnie John. And again, now we're in school. I'm in school in Knoxville, Tennessee. We're in school, and we're saying, oh, so this is what? So they're going to murder in this respect. And when they're not murdering, they're spitting on us and they're throwing things on us. And I am now very pleased to be a member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority. But we recalled, and I'm not saying this for that reason, I mean, I am, but we recalled that Jean Noble, and who was our president at that point, in support of Daisy Bates, got on a train, because that's when we had the train days, put on her white suit and got on a train and went to Little Rock and said, and asked Daisy, Miss Bates, what can we do? What can Delta do? And she said, Miss Bates said, well, the Little Rock Nine are not going to have Christmas. And Jean Noble said, well, we were at that point like 75,000 women of Delta Sigma Theta. We'll see to it that the Little Rock Nine have Christmas. Yeah. You remember that Miss Minnie John was walking alone because she didn't have a phone. Now, that is very hard for kids today to understand.
Yeah.
Because they don't even know a landline because they are land. Yeah, but Miss Minnie John didn't know that nobody was going to school that day. And that's why she was caught alone. And that had to stop. So we're now in school. In 1960, we are a freshman and sophomore. We're in college, right? And in Nashville, which is, I attended Fisk University as an early entrant. In Nashville, of course, the school that started the sit-ins was Tennessee State. But State was a state school. And so they just started to dismiss the students that were leaders. They just dismissed them. And the students at Fisk, Diane Nash, John Lewis, the congressman, was there. Jim Bevel was at Baptist Theological. We all said, because I'm not going to get there till the next year, are saying, well, we're a private school. So they can get rid of the Tennessee State kids, but they can't get rid of us. And that's why Fisk took it up. And Diane Nash, who is probably one of the truly unsung heroines of the civil rights movement.
She really is.
Oh, yeah. Just an incredible woman. And Diane led Fisk University, and we took up the fight in Nashville.
Yeah, and indeed, Diane Nash, I was in D.C. Doing some coverage on the 50th anniversary, but using the occasion really to draw out and make known some of those leaders less known, you know, Bernard Lafayette. And
I saw Bernard recently.
Oh, did you? He was great. Dave Dennis, you know, Dave told the story about how he didn't make the march on Washington because he had to go underground because they were trying to charge him with 360 counts of influencing youth in a bad way or whatever that was after, you know, Medgar Evers was killed. And there was that a little confrontation there with the police. So there is so much that is intertwined in making us, you know, who we are. And we say on the show, you heard me say, well, we discuss the interrelationship between art and politics, right? But, you know, just the era that you grew up in, I mean, your whole experience that you just described, and for our audience, it is the great Nikki Giovanni here in studio discussing this with us, and the impact that had then on your interest in writing. At what point did you know you really wanted to write?
Well, I think, like, well, I'm a Fisk University graduate, and I was a student at Fisk. So, you know, that's what we do. Fisk had one of the great sociology departments. I'm not a sociology major. I was a history major. Du Bois was a Fiskite. You know, I mean, that's what we do. You know,
okay.
If I had my way, Fisk would be a woman's school, and we should be. And I would get, I would keep it right down to just the basic liberal arts, you know, your basic chemistry and math and history and you know, just to kind of give a view.
You turn Fisk into a Spelman.
Well, you know, now you don't want to start this because we think that Spelman already was a Fisk.
Okay.
And Fisk has lost, well, I don't think, well, that's another discussion. I just don't think that we can attract enough men to keep Fisk coeducational, but that is another long discussion.
Yeah.
I would like to very much turn it not into a Spelman, but into a Fisk.
Yeah.
Because when Fisk was started, the one thing that we did was we went against the grain. Mm-hmm. We started as a coeducational school at a time when schools were either male or female.
Mm-hmm.
We were always, of course, interracial. Anybody, you know, we did not discriminate. Anybody could come. But at some point, as we begin to lose funding and really to some degree, it's fair to say identity.
Yeah.
Because Fisk is now trying to be something that there's no place for it. In the real sense of the world, it will always exist because there's no way to let it fall. And again, I'm not upset with the president, but that $10 million or so that he gave to all of the HBCUs was a joke. Because we fine companies for wrongdoing more than that. We just fine, you know, one of the hedge funds, you know, $13 billion.
Yeah.
So, you know, $10 million was absolutely nothing. I would like to see Fisk become a competitor of both Spelman and Bennett. Because as we train and educate women, the men will follow.
I could see that. And of course, the historically black institutions, again, for especially some of our younger listeners, I mean, played such a vital role in the civil rights era, the sit-in movement, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mm-hmm. Fisk, you know, Spelman, you know, the whole
house.
Set of the
Morehouse.
yeah, me, Howard. So, and it seems you were there and you were part of a time when, in a lot of ways, the movement was really at its height. And part of the kind of identity crisis, in a way, that you're describing with the historically black institutions now may also be a reflection of the identity crisis out there. You know what I mean? That generally we're facing. I mean, it really is a different era in that point of view. So you're saying that you're going to Fisk and the training you had in Fisk and the focus and the era, all of that played a movement then into Nikki Giovanni, the National Treasure poet.
Well, see, that's very nice. But, you know, really, I just considered, you know, you have to look at yourself realistically. What could I do? Well, the one thing that I'm good with is words. I mean, mm-hmm. that's about all I'm good with. And so I felt that I needed to make sure as much as I could do it, that my words were true.
Yeah.
That my words described things that other people couldn't describe, because I'm not Bob Moses. I couldn't have gone into Mississippi and done the math camp, which Bob Moses to us was a god. I mean, Bob Moses is still a god. You know, there's no question about that.
And but now his work with the Algebra Project.
Oh, yes.
And whatnot.
I mean, Bob was always a god. I mean, that's mm-hmm. somebody else who we need that movie mm-hmm. of that man. And so I just thought, if this is what I can do, then I should do it to the best of my ability. And the key that's important to me is honest, because you can't live in a fantasy world, you know. And I just mentioned I'm just coming from Accra. And if you go to Accra right now, what you're going to see, and one respect, is going to break your heart, because there's still a lot of poor people. You know, we have a water problem there. We have an electricity problem there.
Yeah.
But we have a great people there. And whatever the people are, from that point, from Cape Coast Castle mm-hmm. to Jamestown or Barbados, as we come across mm-hmm. that ocean, what we have is the birth of a new people. So we have to understand that we are not just the Ashanti Kingdom.
Yeah.
We are also the people we see today. And
that's
the people we see today have that same kindness, that same resilience, that same vision. And we have to find a way to tap into that strength. Because if we just compared Accra to New York, we'd have a problem.
Yeah.
And a crowd would unfairly suffer. I'm not so sure that New York is a great idea. We know LA. But yeah. Maybe it's not the worst idea to have a dirt road, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the worst idea to try to figure out how do we use daylight again, that everything doesn't have to run after midnight. And I never did understand, let me just be really honest about that, how anybody could say anybody black is lazy.
Oh, please.
You know, but you hear it.
Yeah, all the time.
And we stayed with the people. We did not stay at the old Ambassador Hotel mm-hmm. downtown in the high rise. Mm-hmm. We stayed with the people. And it was just a really interesting thing because the people are up at 5:15 in the morning. You mm-hmm. start to hear them stir. Light is going to come up about 5:30, 5:35, and they're working. They're cooking. They're washing clothes. They're getting their wares out. Mm-hmm. The women are putting bottles on their heads, and they're going to walk out. The young men, and they're going to walk out, and they're going to sell that. They're on the highways that don't have any lines in them,
yeah.
And somehow or another they're walking and getting that done. And I just thought, what a great people. I was there only 10 days, and I never heard anybody, you know, there was no rancor. No one is cursing anybody out. Nobody is mm-hmm. banging, you know. And I thought, wow. You know, no, this yeah. is a great thing. Really? I hadn't been in Ghana in like 30 years, and I just thought, this is a great thing. And what I wanted to say, because I was the keynote speaker, I wanted to talk about slavery. Well, of course, Africa is embarrassed by slavery, and they still are. Mm. And it's ridiculous to be embarrassed because they didn't do it.
Yeah.
Somebody, yeah. you know, these people that we're talking to didn't do it. So we have to say, what have we learned and how have we learned it? Because black Americans are fabulous people. And that does not exclude Barbadians or, you know, anybody. Don't misunderstand. But that journey through Middle Passage, of course, is also our journey to Mars. It's our journey through space. Because human beings going from a known to an unknown with no landmarks to keep them human, we have to say, how did they do that and remain sane when they got to the other side?
Yeah.
So this is the black American journey. And yeah. I just wanted to share that because I would love for Ghanaian scholars at Legon University to start to look at Middle Passage.
Yeah,
you know, we look at it all the time. Of course, Du Bois and a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, we're constantly. But I would like to see the African view of Middle Passage. What does this mean? Did somebody actually say to those people enslaved, Godspeed? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that you're telling this story. Just a couple of days ago, I had a conversation with Salma James, who's the widow of C.L.R. James, yeah, wrote the book on the Haitian Revolution. And she was saying, you know, there are no poor countries. There are impoverished people.
Exactly.
But the countries are rich.
Yes.
And not only the mineral wealth that they're trying to get out from under the land, mm-hmm. but just the people and the culture. And looking at a place like Haiti is one example of that. Mm. Most impoverished country, you know, first black republic. And you look at the art. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so that resilience mm-hmm. that you're talking about and that going through the Middle Passage and surviving the Middle Passage and all the thing. I actually did go see I saw The Butler, and I also did see 12 Years a Slave.
I didn't like The Butler, by the way,
yeah.
before we go too
yeah.
far.
Okay.
I really didn't like The Butler because there could be nobody in the position of power that man was in
mm-hmm.
who didn't pass the information that he heard along to somebody,
yeah.
to his pastor. I mean, you have to, how can you show the butler of the White House without showing his relationship to the Pullman porters? Because he's on a train at some point. We know that the Pullman porters were the bankers of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And so how do we get this man, and what we end up with is a movie that's showing his wife. This man married a link. I'm never. He had a great job. Do you know the Lynx? I don't know.
No, I don't.
It's a group.
Yeah.
They're wonderful women. This man married an AKA or a Delta, but she was also a Lynx.
Oh,
and
okay.
She had to be. I mean, I don't know this man.
Yeah.
You know what? But this man has a steady job at the White House, so he is an important man in his community. He has a church that he goes to.
Right.
He has a a lodge. Mm-hmm. He has a place. He has brothers, mm-hmm. right? Now, he is not a college graduate, and so he is not going to be in a fraternity.
Yeah.
But he is in some kind of lodge that he meets with other men. Why didn't we see him talking to his brothers, to his right. friends? Why did we see just his wife is going out with Terrence Howard? And how can we dare to have Terrence Howard, who is a beautiful man, not have a tooth? That was just so insulting.
And how nice the Nixons were. Inviting them to the
and it's like, please give me and I said that to a friend of mine, you know, if this was a story about a Jewish butler mm-hmm. who worked in a Nazi household, we would have seen him passing information
absolutely.
To other Jews. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what
and
you're
so
saying.
And so I resented the fact that all of a sudden we have this guy, like he's just a big Uncle Tom, and he has this woman who is just like a nothing. That's not the way that our society works.
Yeah.
And so I resented the butler.
And survived.
It's just not the way it worked. I don't get to write movies, and you can see why. Because I would have walked off the set. I'm tired of people acting like we don't know any more than we knew in 1920. Mm-hmm. Because that's an old way of thinking about the black community. And it can't be, because it's just not, we know enough to know it's not true.
We're going to take a short station break. When we return, we continue our conversation with award-winning poet Nikki Giovanni.
Flocking to the sea, crowds of people wait for me. Seagulls scavenge, still ice cream. Worries vanish within my dream. Lift my soul down, down by the sea. Lost control.
This is Ed Asner. You're listening to Fearless Drive Time Radio, Sojourner Truth with host Margaret Prescott.
You believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes. You believe in freedom, cannot rest. Hear me talking to you. We believe in freedom.
Welcome back. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're now going to continue our conversation with award-winning poet, activist, mom, Nikki Giovanni. Our guest in studio is the great poet, Nikki Giovanni, and her brand new book, Chasing Utopia, a Hybrid, just fantastic, talking about family, her mom, and food, and the movement, and love, and just about everything. And so that's something else I wanted to ask you about also, because you are a mother, and you are very close to your mother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just you're a poet, you're a writer. I mean, I don't know how you do it. How many books is it? You know,
you kind of lose count. I write little books, though. I mean, you're not going to ever see a 900-page book.
Yeah.
But
just
I was
balancing,
missing.
Just yeah. balancing being a mom. And
well, no, my son
is
45 years old, so he doesn't need me to do that. I enjoyed writing.
Yeah, but back when he was growing up.
Well, you do what you can and hope you have a sane child. But I was in writing Utopia. I was missing my mother because mommy died.
Yeah.
And Utopia, we should talk about, because it was,
yeah,
I think the reason this book feels so good is that there's so much joy in it. But I kind of smiled all the way through it. But Chasing Utopia, Utopia is a beer. And people forget that. My mother was a beer drinker. Mm-hmm. And so every day that I knew my mother, she had a life. I mean, I wasn't born until she was like 27 years old. But when I finally came into knowing this woman is my mother, you know, every day she drank a beer. Mommy had regular blood pressure, both my sister and I have had an older sister. They're both gone now. But my sister and I both have high blood pressure. My sister and I both wear glasses, you know. Mm-hmm. My sister and I both have false teeth. We don't have all mm-hmm. of our teeth. Mommy had her teeth. Mommy had regular blood pressure. And mommy doesn't have to wear glasses. So obviously beer is good for you. I just never liked beer. And yeah. I never did get into it. So I cook with it a lot, and it helps things. But I just never did. But I was missing mommy, and I was being sad. And I said to myself, okay, you can't just sit on your deck and drink, you know, Chardonnay in the morning and then go to red wine in the evening. You know, you just can't do that. And so I thought, well, I should have a beer for mommy, and I should, you know, because you have to mourn. I hate you that do. American thing about, you know, let's go on. I didn't want to go on. I wanted to mourn.
You need to mourn.
You have to stop. And so I said, oh, what I should do is I should go get a beer for mommy and you know, make her proud of me again and go back to work, you know, go mm-hmm. get something done. And I thought, well, if I have to drink a beer, I'm a snob. You don't know that, but I am. And I said, well, then if I have to drink a beer, I want to drink the best beer. I don't want to drink, you know, I don't want to go get a Schlitz. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I went to the Barnes & Noble, actually, and went to the section, you know, that tells you what number one everything is. And I got the beer book, and the number one beer in the world is Utopia. So I thought, well, that's no problem. You know, great. And I wrote down a couple of beers because Japanese make a great beer, too. And I called Keith, who was our beer and wine guy. And I, you know, hey, Keith, it's Nikki. How you doing? Yak, yak. You know, I'd like to get a Utopia. You know, do you have one? Or how long would it take you to order it? And he said, no. No, they will not.
Forget about it.
Yeah, not
right.
me. So uh-huh. I'm too young. And I thought, you're crazy. So I called. There's a place here. It's called Bounty Hunter. And they mm-hmm. sell, if it's liquid, they sell it. And so I called Bounty Hunter, and they know me because I buy wine from them. And it's like, you know, Nikki, we do not sell beer. And I said, why not? He said, well, you know, we're wine dealers. We don't sell beer. And it's like, oh, my goodness. And so I started complaining. You know, I was going across the country complaining. I found out, of course, that Utopia is $350 a pint. But, you know, finding it, you know, you can go to a website, and so they're you know, they're people that put it on the web, but I didn't really want that because you don't know how it's handled. And I was invited, and you know the month, because it was February, I was invited to speak at the CIA, and it's like, okay, well, the CIA knows everything. So I asked...
So you wait, because you wanted to find some beer.
I did, you know, and it was like, well, I'm an American, so, you know, you have to speak to these people, too. You can't just, you know, decide that you're not. And I wanted to do Rosa Parks, so I did, and after it was over, we had a lunch there, and I was like, you know, hey, you know, I wonder if you could do me a favor. I'm looking for Utopia. And Leon Panetta, who's a nice person, Leon says, you know, look deep within yourself. And this is not what we're talking about, Leon, you know. And then I asked an assistant, you know, well, can you help me find Utopia? And it was like, I'm sure if you take the time. You know, it's one of those. I said, no. I need somebody colored. And so I finally found one of the black directors, and I said, I'm looking for Utopia. So he helped me locate, and he said, now, this is where you can find it. But, of course, you know, being a government agent, you can't do anything. I said, that's fine. And I was leaving there, going on up to Boston. So when I got to Boston, I was saying, you know, gosh, I'm trying to find Utopia, and it's the hardest thing in the world. It's a Sam Adams beer. And here I am in Boston, the home of Sam Adams. And so I was just complaining. I was just going.
Yeah, going around.
And the phone rang in the studio.
And not even the CIA could have found you,
Utopia. They could find it, but they couldn't buy it.
I'll buy it for you.
So
they should have told you that before the speech, right?
Well, not exactly. But Sam Adams, the guy who makes it, called in to the radio station. And he said, tell Dr. Giovanni we are sending her a bottle of Utopia and the glasses to drink it out of, because it really is like a brandy. It comes in special glasses. So I was, I've been.
How
thrilled.
Was it? How was
I
it?
Haven't had it yet.
Oh.
So when I go home, I'm going to sit down when I finish this part of my
That'll
tour.
That'll be a celebration.
It is, yeah. I have a Utopia for my mother. So it's kind
of Utopia
fun.
For your mother.
Yes,
that is something else. But looking at, speaking of motherhood and just the plain speaking, the beauty, but also the plain speaking, me, anybody picking up any of your material can relate to it. I'm truly convinced of that.
Oh, thank you.
And when I read, like, when my phone trembles.
Ah, yes.
Oh, Lord. You know that so well.
Yes.
The phone rings in the middle of the night, you know.
It's always bad news. I wrote that for D'Angelo. And it was really funny. He called me. I couldn't do what D'Angelo perhaps had in mind, but I was reminded, as the mother of a son, actually, but that I think mothers must worry also about daughters.
Oh, yeah. But, I have a daughter.
Yeah.
One.
When the phone rings at midnight, you know, I'm a civil rights person, so I've never had a phone ring at that hour that it wasn't bad news, whether it was Robert Kennedy being shot, whether it was some friend being in jail. But you always worry that it's somebody telling you, as Trayvon Martin, and among others, that your son is dead.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to, I wrote that for D'Angelo, but also for all of us who, when the phone rings at midnight, we pray.
Yeah, and then the piece on Robert Champion, the young man who died with the, was it hazing, and
well,
then
I mean, that was
Trayvon,
murder.
You just mentioned Trayvon as well.
Sure. I mean, and to say hazing, I mean, I'm so proud, speaking of young men, I'm so proud of James Martin, who finally walked away from the Miami Dolphins because of Mr. Incognito, that, you know, that has to stop.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they knew. You know that he's not doing this, and nobody knows. He's been dismissed from how many teams? Five teams? Incognito, Richie Incognito. And so they knew what he was up to, and they didn't mind until somebody finally said, you know, this has to stop.
Yeah.
Somebody, you have to quote the great Aretha Franklin, let's call this game exactly what it is.
I know. Get the precision of those notes, Aretha hit it.
But, you know, you mentioned a woman that I want to come back to for just like 2 seconds, because she's great. You mentioned Haiti. And, of course, right now, Edwidge Daticat is, well, of course, Edwidge is an incredible novelist. And I think she's going to be the next American, because she is an American. She's a Haitian American, but American. I think she's going to be our next Nobelist, and I think it's going to be a couple of years. But, you know, Claire of the Sea Light is out. And she's just an incredible, incredible writer. And we're talking about the poverty and what she sees, but she has a great eye that also allows her to tell our story in a terrific way. She's like a young Toni Morrison, just an incredible writer. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Edwidge, because she's so wonderful.
Right. We'll keep that in mind. So you see, when she does win, we could play this
call
little
me
bit.
And
right.
Send me a bit of champagne. Yeah.
How about some Utopia, right?
There you go.
That would work. And then in allowables as well, because the kind of tenderness, and I'm trying to find it here. Right, because the thing about you, it starts out, I killed a spider, not a murderous brown recluse, nor even a black widow. And if the truth were told, this was only a small sort of papery spider who should have run when I picked up the book, but she didn't. You know, then it goes on.
Yeah.
But there's something so tender, and we all know that, because I go through that, right? I see that. It's like, oh, my God, maybe I should try and get it and open the window and, you know, and get it out. But it's that kind of range where you're talking about.
And she scared me, and I smashed her. I don't think I'm allowed to kill something because I am frightened.
Yeah.
And so it's been, I live in the country, and I got to know my neighbors, because I live in a small, I live on a mountain. I got to know my neighbors, and I've lived there now for 25 years, because a couple of squirrels were dead when I was going down the mountain one day, you know, 25 years ago, and there were a couple of dead squirrels, and I made up a flyer and stuck it in all the posts. I was, please don't murder the squirrels. And my neighbors, I've never hit a critter, and I'm very, you know, knock on wood on that, I've never hit a critter. And so I go down the mountain very slowly, but my neighbors like, Nikki, I'm not murdering squirrels. Well, somebody is, because the squirrels were here, and they're crossing the road because they don't know cars. They're doing what they were always doing, and squirrels run and stop, which helps them for most enemies, but for an automobile, it doesn't help them, because it gets them right in the middle of the automobile. So you have to go down the mountain about 20 miles an hour, and you have to keep looking on both sides. So I'm trying to, and again, it's something you work on, because I did. I killed that little spider, and I do have black widows. And what I do is put in my garbage, I have, of course, mothballs, which keeps them out. And they don't like it.
Yeah.
And in my mailbox, I have mothballs for the same reason. Otherwise, I'd reach into my mailbox, and there would be a spider, and it would bite me, and I would have a problem. But I don't want to spray it. I wanted something that would make them say, well, maybe I shouldn't live here. So you're working on it.
Yeah.
You know, we're just human, and being human, we have issues and we make mistakes. But I just want to keep working on trying to be a better human being. And yeah. I want to, and that's what I write about. I just keep, you just think we can do better. I can do better. And I can't ask other people to do better if I can't. But you can't kill things because you don't like them. We have coyotes. Yeah. And I have dogs. I have a little dog. She's a Yorkie.
Oh, what's her name?
Her name is Alex.
Alex.
And Alex is sick right now, so she's on prednisone, so she weighs 13 pounds.
Yeah.
But she's normally about 7 pounds. So the coyotes, if I let her out at night, the coyotes would come
it. Yeah.
And they would eat her.
Yeah.
But the coyotes are hungry.
Yeah. Right?
So I know that I cannot feed the coyotes. I'm not going to leave food out. I'm going to close my garbage. But I'm also not going to let my dog out.
Because she'll get eaten.
But I'm not going to hurt the coyotes because actually they are fairly good neighbors, you know. And so you just have to be careful. You have to turn your lights on. And we live with things. Again, Americans are you would think that we were a cowardly nation, the way we are constantly destroying something because we don't like it. I don't like drones killing people.
Yeah.
I just don't like the whole idea that anybody can get some kind of assault weapon and come into a mall or come into, as they've done recently, or come into LAX and shooting people. All of that has to stop. And I don't know why it's so difficult to stop gun violence. Now, that doesn't mean that people won't hurt each other, because people probably will. But the idea that anybody can get an assault weapon and a lot of magazines and walk into a public place and shoot people, says that's an insanity. And the NRA, I mean, that's not what the Constitution says. So I don't know how they get away with that. And I think if people want to quote the Constitution, they ought to read it.
Yeah, and I did want to ask you about violence and this age we're in, because you interact with young people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is, and I actually wanted to ask about literacy rates and writing and all that. But before that, if you look at what's happening now, mothers are the fastest growing population of people going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Single mothers and their children, fastest growing population of the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
Welfare reform under Clinton, safety net totally dismantled.
Mm-hmm.
Extreme poverty, you know, gone up. Caregiving has been devalued. You know, that caring, you know, used to be in the community, you're looking out for everybody else's child. What you doing? When your mama comes home, you know, whatever, you know, that kind of thing. And a lot of that now with children being left alone so much. And Gabor Mate, who is a doctor up in Canada, deals a lot with addiction, but also, you know, poverty and a whole set of things. He says, we're now dealing with a generation of people who, in a way, get what they know from other children,
mm-hmm.
right? 4-year-olds learning from other 4-year-olds, et cetera. So you have that kind of caring removed from the community and kind of replaced with things, because you keep the kids, you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
with things, the militarism, the poverty, the violence, the poverty draft, it's all sort of mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are at this place where our babies are suffering,
mm-hmm.
and the mothers are suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just wondered, given your work with young people and also your writing and your wisdom on so many things, and the fact that you were also so close to your mother, and that kind of relationship was so important. Any comments on that?
Well, I've been lucky that I've been close to a lot of old ladies, and I'm a big fan of old ladies. But it's very clear, first of all, it's very clear the prison doesn't work. And I mean, these are like longer, you know,
discussions
that make me sound crazy.
Yeah.
But the money we put into prisons really should be put into things like daycare. And obviously we need to pay, okay, let me slow it down and do it this way. School buildings always have to be heated and the water has to be on.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a building that we only use, you know, maybe 10 hours a day at most.
Mm-hmm.
School buildings should be open 24 hours a day.
Hmm.
And we should start with, first of all, building in per population. This is not a hard thing to do, so that mothers can drop kids off. And we hire teachers, because we hire prison guards to do horrible things to people when we could, in fact, hire people. Grandmothers, now I'm in the country, so we have grandmothers and grandfathers who actually, if we sent the bus out to pick them up, would cook. And I'm a big fan of beans because I like beans. I am.
Brown, black, any kind of bean,
if it's
don't
a bean,
matter.
I like it. Christmas beans, you know, speckled beans, I like beans. So if we didn't do anything but every 2 weeks have a different bowl of beans for lunch, the kids would get a healthy lunch. If we didn't do anything but have cornbread, they would get a healthy lunch. And give them a break on it. Give them lemonade sometimes and a nice something for dessert. We also know if we brought the grandparents in and just had the grandfather sit in the lunchroom, for example, of your junior high school, you know how that would change? For every table, have a grandfather there, just an old man who's going to sit there and tell them stories, and they're going to laugh at him. But they're also going to behave. They're also going to learn this is what a man does. This is what a woman does. Put those people to work. Let those people work for us. But also then give them some space. Make a lounge someplace that they can sit down, they can take a nap, sit and sit in their chair, right?
Mm-hmm.
Put them, when the parents get off from work at 6 o'clock, let them come in at 7 or 8 o'clock
get
and
a little rest.
Let them have a beer. Let them come into the school. Come on, because I'm tired of that, that hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Let them come into the school and have a beer. They can talk to the teachers. They can talk to the older people. They can take the kids home. Because the building is there and the building's being heated. Did that just make sense?
Yeah,
we're spending money in a way that is being non-productive. And I think that it's time that we realize that we owe each other. I'm tired of billionaires deciding that they've done a good deed because they gave $1 million away, which $1 million didn't do anything. And they are holding on to resources in the community in a way that's just not necessary. We just, I don't know if you read the financial pages, and I don't often because it makes me crazy, but we just find an investor group. We just find them $1 billion, but they made 13.
Yeah, and Wachovia for laundering billions of dollars in drug money when the kids are in end up in prison allegedly for drugs, and there they are, get a little slap on the wrist and get away
and
with
so
it.
So it makes you crazy.
Yeah.
But I think, again, what we're needing is leadership. And I think that maybe the time for politicians has passed. Maybe the time for that level of what we would call democracy. Maybe we need really to sincerely go back to a Republican form of government, which is to say we really do have representative government, because right now we don't. And if we deal with what the majority wants, we have what we have, which is stalemate. What we need is somebody to represent the people.
Yeah. And I'm looking at the clock, and I can't believe how the time has flown.
Oh.
You know, I'm going to have to just come out in the country and sit at your feet
hear some more
of this stuff. But finally, because, you know, when I was a little girl in my little poverty-stricken village, you know, the countryside in Barbados, and no television and running water and all that kind of stuff, and a book would just take you there. And when you have... I wish I could live in a book. And then I wish I could live in music. And I wish I could live in a painting.
I did that for a girls group in Roanoke, because they did these things. And I was invited to be a part of them. And I thought, well, this is what I want the girls to learn to do.
Yeah.
You know, that we figure. And I do. I wish I could live in a book, because I would be incredibly... incredibly happy.
Yeah, me too.
I like Barbados a lot. I used to spend a lot of time in St. James.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
down Fitz Village, and that's where I stay, actually.
Paul Marshall is from Barbados, one of our great novelists, absolutely.
Well, you know, I've run out of time, and that makes me really, really sad, but I know that you're on just this incredible schedule, and we're so delighted that you took this time to visit with us just a little bit, and we hope we get a chance to visit with you again, Ms. Nikki Giovanni.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All righty. We are out of time today. Show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, all who helped to make this show possible. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Remember to like and friend us on Facebook. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott, and our website is sotrueradio.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 8:53 a.m. Next up at the top of the hour, we have Sojourner Truth Radio at 9 o'clock. We have One Land, Many Voices, exploring political, social, and cultural issues affecting Palestine, Israel, with host Leila Kanaan. At 10, we have Voices for the Animals. We hear from Ingrid Newkirk, the legendary founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, about her new book, Animal Kind. Then at 10:30, it's Film at 11, a panel broadcast reviewing the latest films and shows from the multiplex to the art house and beyond. Then at 11, it's Radio Zine. Suzanne LeGrand speaks with self-described radical pleasurist Sophia Traeger and Catherine Rowland, the author of Pleasure Gap, American Women and the Unfinished Sexual Revolution. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Hello, we're Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There is no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word, or message us on Instagram at @PACUnderground.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series featuring Robin and Linda Williams. With a rich career spanning over four decades, the duo have made it their mission to perform the music they love, a blend of bluegrass, folk, old-time, and acoustic country. Robin and Linda sang Americana before it was cool. The show is Friday, March 13th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland, Oregon. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
By King Ghidorah.
people running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
I got involved with Code Pink Women for Peace when in the Bush era, that just tipped me over the edge. And they organized a delegation to go to Gaza in 2009 after Operation Cast Lead. So that Operation Cast Lead was December 08 to 09 in January. And